Support for this public radio podcast comes from AIG Travel Guard, providing travel insurance designed to help travelers face the unexpected. Learn more at travelguard.com.
I'm Dick Gordon. Coming up, the story of a shy, young Episcopal preacher from New York who took a summer job at the Ebenezer Baptist Church in Atlanta. This was back in 1961. Gordon Brewster stayed with Martin Luther King Sr. that summer, Daddy King they called him, and he got some wonderful lessons in the power of the Baptist preaching tradition from both Daddy King and Dr. King himself. But 1961 was also a dangerous time for Northerners to promote integration and civil rights in the South. Late one evening, Gordon was invited to meet a number of white men at a church. He didn't know it was a trap.
I walked in, and it was kind of the evening. I walked towards the sanctuary, and a black woman was mopping the floor. And as I came near her, she said, "Be careful," whispered it under her breath, "Be careful."
Gordon Brewster will be here after the news to talk about his summer of 1961 with the King family. In 1961, Gordon Brewster was a seminary student in New York City. They were looking for students to volunteer to spend the summer in Southern churches. Gordon knew exactly where he wanted to go because for the past few years he'd been reading about the bus boycotts led by Dr. Martin Luther King. Gordon also knew that the Ebenezer Baptist Church in Atlanta was where both Dr. King and his father, Martin Luther King Sr., were pastors.
I raised my hand with vigor and energy, and I didn't see any competition, and all of a sudden the words came out, "Brewster gets Ebenezer for the summer."
It was to be the beginning of a remarkable experience for Gordon Brewster. Everything from eating peach cream in the King family garden to powerful confrontations over race and religion. I'm Dick Gordon. This is The Story.
The Story is produced by North Carolina Public Radio, WUNC. It's co-produced and distributed by American Public Media.
When I talked with Gordon Brewster, I told him how envious I was, how lucky he'd been to have had that summer of 61 with the King family and the people at the Ebenezer Baptist Church. Gordon told me that he first met Reverend Martin Luther King Sr., known to most as Daddy King, when he arrived in June on a hot day in the middle of the week.
I got down there on Wednesday, met Reverend King, and went to his house for dinner, and immediately he said we had to go to the prayer meeting after dinner. Well, I was exhausted, but I was not going to refuse. I was the only white person in the congregation, and they started to sing the hymn. Reverend King came over and handed me a Bible and said, "Brewster," he always called me Brewster, "you're going to preach after the service." And I had never preached a sermon in my life, and so I totally panicked. I looked in the Bible to figure out what was the longest lesson that I could possibly find, and I found the Sermon on the Mount finally as they sang Amen and began to read it from the Bible and then preached a sermon.
Less preaching.
Exactly. Get as much reading as I could and get as many words, all the blessed ones and the woe to this. And I figured I could fill in that somehow with some stuff. And as soon as I read it, somebody in the front row said, "Amen," and another one said, "Preach it, Brewster," and then somebody said, "Hallelujah," and it scared me out of my wits. I had never been in a service where people 8 feet away, 10 feet away were shouting back at me with enthusiasm, so that really did scare me out of my wits. As we were driving home together, he said, "Brewster, how'd you like the service?" And I said, "Well, I just loved it," but I never told him it was the first sermon I'd ever preached.
You were at this time facing a really dramatic difference in preaching styles. You were raised in the Episcopal Church in the Northeast, and I would imagine the kind of preaching that you knew from the pulpit was pretty formal.
It was very formal. Most people, including myself, would write out their text. I had never preached a sermon, but if I had, I would have written it out very carefully and followed a manuscript. In that church, Daddy King would never use a manuscript, and he or Dr. King would just preach, letting the Holy Spirit come alive in the present and see where it went. That was one difference, and the other was this wonderful response from the congregation to the preacher that just was encouraging and enlivening and just very different from a northern church.
Stand up for righteousness. Stand up for justice. Yeah. Stand up for truth. Yeah. And lo, I will be with you even until the end of the world. I tell you, I've seen the lightning flash. I've heard the thunder roll. I've felt sin breakers dashing, trying to conquer my soul. But I heard the voice of Jesus saying, still to fight on. He promised never to leave me, never to leave me alone. No, never alone. No, never alone. Promise never to leave me. Never to leave me alone.
Daddy King had asked his parishioners for a volunteer, someone who would put Gurdon Brewster up for the summer. After a few Sundays with no takers, Gurdon got a room in Daddy King's home.
I just took this in my stride. I sort of didn't quite appreciate the incredible experience that was unfolding and all the opportunities that I had. And as I say, I was a young 24, and thinking that I was about 45 and really in reality being about 16. I was very young.
Aside from the preaching that you did and the work with the youth and the more public part of your time in Georgia that summer, you also had a lot of personal time with Daddy King himself, and it revolved around breakfast. Tell me a little bit about that.
Oh, I'd get up at 6:30 or 7, go down into the kitchen, let his dog out, and dog would chase squirrels around the yard. I'd start the bacon cooking so that I'd get the good smells coming in the house and the coffee percolating, and because it turned out that Daddy King really liked those good smells wafting through his house. And then Daddy King came down for breakfast, and I said, I'm fairly good around the kitchen. After he tasted my hominy grits, that was the big test, he figured that I was a good cook. I cooked for him every single morning while I was there. And after a few days, I began to talk to him about his life. That's when some of his stories began to unfold.
Gurdon recalls that Daddy King told those stories somewhat reluctantly, but through the summer he loosened up a bit. He told Gurdon that he'd come from a sharecropper's family in a small place called Stockbridge outside Atlanta. And while his father had farmed, his mother did domestic work.
His mother, who had never gone to school, kept pushing Daddy King into school, and his father kept pulling him out to help around the farm and to walk behind the mule. So there was this tug of war between the mother and the father. And he went to this school, and the teacher was Mrs. Lowe. She took him out and the class under a tree, and she pointed out the stars and the North Star. Then she began to talk about people who had followed that star and had escaped slavery and gone across the river into the Promised Land. So he never forgot the North Star. He would always look up at it and say, there it is, Brewster. And there was a train that rolled through Stockbridge. She would put them all on that train in their imagination and say, this train is going now to Atlanta, and then it's going to Chicago, New York, and Boston, and Los Angeles, Detroit, all over the United States. And then she would take them to Paris and Rome in their imagination. And he said he left those days, his head just swelling with ideas about where he could go in the world. One day he got on that train and woke up the next morning in Atlanta, having come from Stockbridge, and then he began to go to school. So he went to this school for black children, and after taking the tests, he realized that the principal put him back into the fifth grade, and by that time he was 18 or 19 years old. He described what it was like sitting in these tiny little desks being 19 years old with these fifth graders. And he just said, Brewster, it was just so humiliating, but he wasn't going to stop. The moment that I remember him describing was one time the principal came to his classroom and called him out because his father was in the hall. His father called him Mike. Mike, he said, you've got to come home with me. You've got to work the farm. You've got to work behind the mule. I can't do it alone anymore. It's just too much for me. You've got to come home. And Daddy King looked at his father and realized that if he went home, he would never go back to school again. And he finally had to say, Dad, I can't go back with you. I can't go back with you. Well, the father pleaded, and he just said he remembered all of his life, the sound of his steps, father walking down those steps, walking away from him, walking across the street. And he said he never forgot that.
Ain't gonna let nobody know it. Turn me round, turn me round, turn me round. Ain't gonna let nobody know it. Turn me round, keep on a walking, keep on a talking, marching up the freedom lane. Ain't gonna let segregation know it. Turn me round, turn me round, turn me round. Ain't gonna let segregation know it. Turn me round and keep on a walking, yeah. Keep on a talking, yeah. Marching up to freedom, yeah. Hang on a
leg. Gordon Brewster also set himself to work that summer. He wanted to bring young black and white church groups together. He wanted to learn. And he did. More on that in just a moment. I'm Dick Gordon from American Public Media. This is The Story.
Turn me round, turn me round, turn me round. Ain't gonna let that nervous Nelly, Lordy. Turn me round, keep on a walking, yeah, yeah. Keep on a talking, yeah. I'm marching up to freedom, yeah.
Ain't gonna let you fit the Lordy.
Turn me round, turn me round. Turn me round, ain't gonna let you preach it, Lordy. Turn me round, keep on a walking, Lordy. Keep on a talking, Lordy. Marching up to freedom, Lord.
Hang on a lead, may I kill it, Lordy.
Turn me round, turn me round. Turn me round, ain't gonna let me kill it, Lordy. Turn me round, keep on a walking, Lordy. Keep on a talking, Lordy. Marching up to freedom, Lord.
Ain't gonna let no Uncle Tom a load it.
Turn me round, turn me round, turn me round. Ain't gonna let no Uncle Tom a load it. Turn me round, keep on a walking, yeah, yeah. Keep on a talking, yeah, yeah. Marching up to freedom, yeah.
Ain't gonna let nobody load it.
Turn me round, turn me round, turn me round. Ain't gonna let nobody load it. Turn me round, keep on a walking, yeah. Keep on a talking, yeah. Marching up to freedom, yeah.
I'm Dick Gordon. This is The Story. I'm talking with Gordon Brewster. He's now retired after preaching for 35 years at Cornell University in New York. But through the summer of 1961, when he was a seminary student, he helped the Martin Luther King family at the Ebenezer Baptist Church in Atlanta.
I was very fortunate. 1961 was a time when it was novel, if not appropriate, for a white person to work in a black church and to go and call on people and to be with them. So the 1961 experience was just the right moment.
Almost like there was a window in time for you for that kind of communication.
There was just kind of a miracle in my life that I heard about it, and they were open in 1961 to having a white person be in their church. And then I was just kind of curious and adventuresome and would call on these people at their homes and talk to them on their front steps and rock with them in their rocking chairs and drink Kool-Aid with them in the heat, and I just loved talking with people.
One part of Gurdon's ministry was to pray with people who were too sick or too old to leave their homes. After one such visit, he saw an elderly African-American woman sitting on a wooden crate in an open corridor of an apartment complex. Gurdon heard her singing a hymn. He could see that she was blind.
She said, "Find another crate and we'll make a congregation of two." And I didn't know what I was getting into, but I was pretty game to try. So I brought over this crate and we sat down together, and she grabbed a hold of my knee with claws like an eagle's talon, and she began to sing hymns. And so she noticed that I wasn't singing, so she finally told me this was a congregation of two, not just one, and got me singing with her.
What was the hymn you were singing?
One of them was Softly and Tenderly, Jesus is Calling.
So what did it sound like singing? Would you sing it slowly, quickly? I'm going to put you to work here.
I gather you are. Oh, she sang slowly. She was blind, and she had her left hand squeezing my knee, and she swayed back and forth, and she finally began to sing. I could hear the rumbles coming up out of her chest, and she finally began to sing softly and tenderly, real slow. Softly and tenderly, Jesus is calling, calling for you and for me. And she went on. So that was one of the hymns that she sang.
She challenged you on some point. What was it that she challenged you on?
Oh, my. She looked at me and she wondered what it was that white people sang about. She asked if I'd ever been hungry, and I said, well, quite honestly, I had never been hungry. And she asked if I'd ever been driven out of a house with the gun at my back, and I said, no, never been driven out of a house. Ever had your house burned down? No, never had my house burned down. And she finally looked over towards me and said, well, what then do you people sing about? Because if you're not hungry, you can't really sing about the great banquet of Jesus. And if you have never been driven out of your house, you can't sing about the promised land. So she really challenged me, what do you sing about? And put me on the spot, I have to admit.
Was it confrontational? I mean, was she challenging your right to be with her there and singing the hymn with her?
It was not confrontational. She was just very, I think she was curious.
Huh.
She was terribly old, and she said that she had was born just a few years after President Lincoln had been killed. So she was just as old as the mountains and probably really wondered, because she had gone through so many trials and hard experiences, wondered what white people sang about. I remember she said something like, well, you know, you've crossed the river, gotten to the other side, gotten to the promised land, she said, but you left a few people behind. How do you sing about that, she said. Well, I had nothing to say. And she began to sing something else.
Did that encounter on that day end amicably?
Oh, very, very, yeah. She kept hold of my knee, and finally I put my hand on hers, and we really were a congregation of two. We swayed back and forth, and it was very, very, very hot singing hymns. I mean, looking back on it, it was kind of a funny sight. I don't know if anybody looked at us, but we made a congregation of two. And finally I said goodbye and walked down the stairs and got into my old car, and I saw her walking towards the balcony. I rolled down my window, and she hollered out, take your harp down from the tree, Reverend, and sing. So that was the last she talked to me.
We were on a journey to a better place, made up by our Redeemer for to save by grace. Oh, where the tears would disappear from every face, just across the pond. When you think about the many loved ones there, who are waiting in the land so bright and fair, free from every sorrow, free from pain and care, how we long for home.
I'm Dick Gordon. You're listening to The Story. Gurdon Brewster had his difficult moments that summer of 61. He was jeered when he was seen in a car with African-American men. He was confronted at a gas station. White church leaders were hostile to his ideas of integration. One night, he was invited to a white church to speak about Dr. King and civil rights. He says now he should have been suspicious, but back then he was eager for the opportunity.
I went and visited one church outside of Atlanta a little bit, and I walked in, and it was kind of the evening. I walked towards the sanctuary, and a black woman was mopping the floor. And as I came near her, she said, "Be careful," whispered it under her breath. Well, I walked, was greeted by eight white people filled with energy. I was brought into a room, and they had all kinds of questions. The more I talked about what I was doing, all of a sudden I realized I was in kind of hostile territory, at which point the door opened and this black woman with a mop said, "Be careful, the floor is wet," which I've just mopped. So I heard this sign, "Be careful," twice. I had the feeling she was talking to me, but I had no idea what she was really saying, because I was in my element talking to these white people about what was going on in the black church at that time. Well, I got out into the parking lot, and it was pitch black. And all of a sudden, three guys came up to me, one of which had been in that meeting. And they grabbed hold of my shirt and said a couple of nasty words, which I won't repeat on the radio here, but scared me out of my wits. I thought they were going to beat me up. And I just stood limp, nonviolently. And all of a sudden, the door of the church opened. A great shaft of light shone out onto this parking lot, and I heard this woman's mop cracking against the door jamb. And I said to myself, "Good gracious, she's saved me." And it was like an angel. And as soon as the light hit the parking lot in the dark, all these people ran. And while the light was still there, I got into my car, put the accelerator to the floor, and and tore off.
I mean, you could have been in real danger. Back in 61 was a time when a lot of people in the South so severely resented Northern interference that, you know, kids were being killed for coming down to the South and
that
working.
That is true. Yeah. I could have been in, and I think I would have been in danger. I think had I run, they would have probably beaten me up. I could easily have seen them put me in the back of a truck and tossed me in some dark river. I mean, I could have been in real danger. And the next morning, I was really kind of trembling by this. And, of course, I despised those three people that accosted me in the parking lot. And I really, without an appointment, almost ran into Dr. King's office. The receptionist sort of realized I was filled with agitation. He had calls coming in from the Justice Department, and somehow she let me into his office. And I said, "Dr. King, how do you love your enemy?" I began to realize that being nonviolent and taking the hose or a billy club or something and not fighting back is one thing. But loving those people that hurt you, loving your enemy, is something totally different. I said, "How do you do that?" Well, the phone rang from the Justice Department, and he couldn't answer. And then I asked him again, and it came in from somebody else. And finally, he simply said, "Brewster, you've got to go deeper. Reach deeper. Reach deeper into the source of love." And that's what he had to say. But I came away realizing that loving your enemy is a lifelong task. And those people that did it back then, I had tremendous admiration for.
Men must see that force begets force, hate begets hate, toughness begets toughness, and it is all a descending spiral, ultimately ending in destruction for all and everybody. Somebody must have sense enough and morality enough to cut off the chain of hate and the chain of evil in the universe. And you do that by love.
I'm Dick Gordon. You're listening to The Story. Back in the summer of 1961, Gurdon Brewster was 24 years old. Dr. King was just in his early 30s, but Gurdon says he saw that Dr. King had a clear sense of purpose even at such a young age.
It was just astounding, astounding that he, say, in Montgomery, in the age of 25 or 26, began to lead that whole bus boycott, and they did that for a year or two, and he began to get national fame doing that. It was just astounding how self-possessed he was and how he began to understand what this mission was all about. And then as he moved to Atlanta and created the Southern Christian Leadership Conference, SCLC, he began to have a vision of what he was doing and how he was really to follow the gospel.
One of your experiences that summer, though, put you in one of Dr. King's nonviolence training seminars, and that didn't go quite as smoothly as you might have hoped. What happened there?
We broke down into small pairs, and I somehow got to talking with a very elderly woman who said she was 93. She had said she had never really talked to a white person before in any kind of deep way. So for about 5 minutes, we had a wonderful conversation. And then we had to simulate getting on a bus and being pushed back to the rear of the bus and trying to act nonviolently. And I got in that situation and didn't like being pushed around, manhandled, shoved to the back of the bus. I went along with it, but I had the feeling that a lot of the people, I was the only white person there, they were sort of saying, well, now it's his turn to feel what it's really like.
And the pushing and the shoving had some edge to it, did it?
I think it had some edge. I felt it anyway.
Yeah.
I felt it. And then I got into a small group at the end. One guy got up and he was just very hostile to me and took off his shirt and showed me the scars where he had been beaten and said he wasn't going to sit down until I left the room, at which point I heard steps behind me. All of a sudden, this woman reached out over the group with her cane and poked this man on his shoulder, at which point he turned around immediately, furious, and she said, remember her words, something like, boy, you've got a lot to learn about nonviolence, at which point he left. So there was a lot of tension, and once again, I seemed to have been saved by somebody who understood where I was coming from.
I know you put a lot of time that summer into trying to bring kids together, church groups, and that there was considerable resistance from some of the white church leaders, but you prevailed. You actually got a group of them together late in the summer. Describe that meeting for me. I mean, was it the success that you'd hoped it would be?
It was a wonderful success. I finally got, with a lot of effort, about three or four white youth groups to come to Ebenezer and to meet with our youth group. When I got them together, we had some general conversations, and then I brought them together into pairs and carefully paired my leaders with what I thought were their leaders, and they began to talk together. And then pretty soon Dr. King came in and he talked to the group, and I think they were very impressed by that. But both white and black youth members said they had never talked to another person this way in their whole lives, and they were 16 to 18 years old.
What were they talking about, Gurdon? What were the sorts of things that they were exchanging?
I had them talk about what it was, had they ever been felt discrimination, and what it was like to be discriminated against. Or on the other hand, what it was like to go to a lunch counter and be able to take your cold drink and sit down easily and be served and watch the black people unable to go to a lunch counter. So I had people talk about their real experiences of being excluded and or of being included. That really kind of bonded people. I had a hard time breaking them apart.
Did you ever hear from any of those kids again in later years?
I went down to Ebenezer in the 80s. I looked out over the group and I simply asked if any of my youth group were around, and probably six to eight of them stood up. I was just totally amazed. Actually, about 2 weeks ago, I got a phone call from another member of the youth group. I got an email from one of the ones that I went fishing with. So they are around, and I think at some point we'll have another reunion.
How do you do? Everybody, how do you do?
Gordon Brewster was so moved by his summer with the King family that he says in reflection he never asked himself if his time there had made any difference to them. He learned that he did have a place in that family when Dr. King was assassinated, and he was invited to drive Daddy King to the funeral. We'll talk about that in just a moment. I'm Dick Gordon from American Public Media. This is The Story. I'm Dick Gordon. This is The Story.
Oh, Lord, I'm waiting on you. Oh, Lord, I'm waiting on you. Can't do nothing till the Spirit comes down here, Lord, waiting on you.
In the summer of 1961, Gordon Brewster was an apprentice preacher at the Ebenezer Baptist Church in Atlanta. He was there with Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. and his father, Daddy King. He's written about that summer in a memoir called No Turning Back. In that book, Gordon tells of one time when Daddy King confronted him with a question. Daddy King purposely used hard, racist language in that question, and it went like this. Brewster, have you ever been called a nigger? No, I answered. Well, he continued, how do you preach to the soul of a man who has been called a nigger all his life, and whose mother and father have been called nigger all their lives, and nigger is all they know? How do you preach to the soul of a man when he has no hope?
He had been working with people from the 30s and the 40s and the 50s and leading boycotts and leading voter registration and dealing with people in the Depression who had nothing and who were filled with anger, would come to church filled with anger. He somehow had to bring his teaching of the gospel into their lives. He really knew it was a challenge.
What was his answer to that question? How did he do it?
He was a marvelous storyteller. The tradition of black preaching in rural Georgia was such that when he was a boy, he would just memorize and memorize and memorize the Bible and memorize singing and songs and hymns. And he would just start to talk, and he would preach for an hour, have people roaring with laughter in 1 minute and crying another minute, and weave the gospel stories in and out of very human stories. As a person able to engage the emotions of the congregation, he was just wonderful. Of course, Dr. King took on some of that power in his talk, but Daddy King, he had another way that he preached, which amazed me. He would sometimes stop his sermon right in the middle and address an individual. "Now, Bessie," he might say, "what's happening in your life?" Or he'd talk to another guy, "and what are you doing?" Obviously, it would put them on the spot.
Would he expect an answer, or would people just...
And sometimes he'd expect an answer. Sometimes they'd just sort of slink down into their pew. But he would go wherever the Spirit led him and then weave it back into the gospel so that people would really be caught up in his sense of what the faith was all about.
And did you learn from him? Did you learn something of this style of preaching yourself?
Oh, I wish I had. I wish I had. I'm not that kind of a preacher. I wanted to be, and somehow I still am not. I still am not able to talk as freely, as openly, without notes and really thinking it through, worrying what I'm going to say next. I think he did influence me a lot, as did Dr. King, in just showing me this other style of preaching, but I never really became that good at it, shall I say.
There's a moment that you describe in your writing about your summer. I think it's your last sermon at Ebenezer Baptist Church, though, when you actually get a conversation going with the congregation. You feel almost lifted up by the response you're getting from the people in the church.
That is true. I guess I spoke enough that summer so that I began to get used to and really enjoy the dialogue that would come back at me when I started to talk. And when I began to get excited, which I can do, the people would begin to get excited. And as they got excited, I got more excited. And it just, we kind of fed off on each other's excitement and understanding. And it just kind of picked me up. And I could feel that this is a wonderful way to give a sermon. And when you go back into my white church, nobody talks. You don't really know whether anybody's listening or not.
What would I have heard if I was sitting there in the church on that day?
You would have heard me open my mouth and say something, and before I finished what I was saying, you would have heard, "Preach it, Brewster. Tell it like it is. Hallelujah. Amen." And then I would say a few other things, and all of a sudden somebody else would say, "Hallelujah," and it would go on. I would get sort of excited by it, and I'd have to sort of catch my notes again and figure out where I was, and people would begin to cheer me on.
I like the call from Daddy King. Make it plain, Brewster. Make it plain.
Make it plain, Brewster.
What was he telling you? Was he saying just strip it down? Don't fancy it up with big words? What was he saying?
I think probably that's what he was saying. You know, just speak from the heart. Make it simple from the heart, direct from your heart to people's hearts. And don't elaborate it with all kinds of quotations and frills and flowers. Just make it plain.
I'm Dick Gordon. You're listening to The Story. Gordon Brewster returned to the North and finished seminary. He got married, started a family, and began work as an assistant chaplain at Cornell University. 5 years later, he heard once again from the King family.
All of a sudden, I got a letter, first from Mrs. King, then from Daddy King, and then even from Dr. King, asking me to go down and be their assistant in the church. I began in 1966. And I was just amazed at that invitation. I confess I was a little apprehensive because the mood of the nation had really changed from 61 to 66. Malcolm X had spoken very strongly and had been killed, and Stokely Carmichael had talked about black power. So the sense of black power was very strong. People were not so excited about the nonviolent approach. And I could sense that, and I was sort of apprehensive about accepting that. But I ended up going down there for the summer with my wife and two children, just seeing what it was like and really seeing what it might have been like if I were to accept that invitation. And probably I was right. It was not an easy time to bring up white children, for example, if you were living in a black neighborhood. My wife worked hard at helping others build a Head Start center for young black and white children. The day before it was to open, it was bombed and burned to the ground. So one realized that there was just danger and hostility with angry white people and with some angry black people, and the atmosphere was just quite different.
It was an honor to be asked, though.
Oh, it was a big honor to be asked, that's right.
I mean, I understand your calculation at the time. I wonder if in the years since then you've ever looked back at that moment and regretted your decision not to.
Part of me regrets it. Yes, of course, it would have been an incredible assignment. It was clearly walking into some danger, some hostility. I think the mood of Ebenezer was not quite as open to white people in 1966, but they were still very open to me. But the mood was different, and I'm kind of one who is interested in trying new things and going after some adventure, and I think often I wonder what it would have been like had I done that. I sometimes wish I had.
And it was only 2 years after that that Dr. King himself was assassinated, and you went to the funeral with his father. You went with Daddy King.
Yes, I did. I went down there and somehow became Daddy King's chauffeur. I drove him the day before. He was giving a sermon at another person's funeral, and we went and looked at Dr. King's grave. And then it was just a hole in the ground. A few people were digging it and standing around.
Why did Daddy King want to go on the day before?
Well, you know, I just don't know. I do know that for a few moments I could see tears in his eyes. Then he kind of clenched his fist and wiped the tears away, and I didn't see many tears after that. And then we went to the church for the funeral. We wanted to get there very early, and he made sure that I had a seat inside of Ebenezer for the funeral service, and that was a very powerful moment, obviously.
Gurdon Brewster says that after the assassination of Dr. King, something died in him as well, and that for years and years he didn't tell these stories. It was talking about civil rights with a fourth-grade class that brought all his memories back.
Precious Lord, take my hand, lead me on, let me stand. I get so tired, I am weak, thou art strong. Through the storm, through the night, lead me on to the light. Take my hand,
take my hand,
precious Lord,
precious Lord,
lead me on. Precious Lord, take my hand, lead me on.
You're listening to The Story. I'm Dick Gordon. The year after Dr. King's assassination, Gurdon Brewster invited Daddy King to come up north and preach to his congregation at Cornell University.
I had invited a number of children from the church school and other church schools to come and sit in the front row. And I whispered in his ear as he went to the pulpit, I said, Daddy King, preach here just like you preach at Ebenezer. I said, don't hold back. He got into the pulpit and began to talk, and pretty soon his fist came down under the pulpit and the children all began to laugh.
College students laughed at him.
They kind of laughed. They didn't know. They'd never seen a person with such vehemence and energy before. And he pounded the pulpit again, and they laughed. And finally he looked over at me, and he said, what's the matter, Brewster? Don't you preach here? And, well, I didn't preach quite that way.
Did he turn them, though? Did he win them over?
Oh, of course. He was such a winning figure that they weren't laughing at him in a way. They were laughing with him, but they had never seen such energy before. And that service, he talked about losing his son. And then a year later, his other son, A.D., died. And then a few years later, his wife was killed as she was playing the organ at Ebenezer. So this man had not traveled much after that and was just filled with tragedy, having lost his two sons and his wife. I remember him saying that he was a man of gratitude, and even though he had lost a lot, he could imagine that God could still take more things from him. And because he still had a lot, he was going to be a man of gratitude, and no one could take gratitude away from him.
He said something very flattering about you at that time, too.
That was another pause, and his pauses were long. His pauses were enough to make the congregation nervous, wondering whether the speaker had lost his place or something. And finally he said, "Brewster is like a son to me." That completely, I don't know what, overwhelmed me. I had no idea. I didn't have any idea what effect that I had had on him. I had gone into his house. I had treated him well and fondly, and we laughed together, and we somehow got along wonderfully well together. But being 24 and he was in his 60s, I just had no sense that I would mean anything to him. I began to realize that he had meant a lot to me. I had lost my father when I was 14. He sort of became like a father figure to me. And I began to realize, you know, years after that, probably he had never had a white person stay in his house before or for more than a night or two, if that, and never had really worked that closely and with a white person the way I had worked with him and talked to him over these many breakfasts.
It's so interesting to listen to you talk about the relationship that the two of you had, because I'm still kind of shaking my head just at the good fortune that put you in his home and at his church in that summer of the early 60s.
It was just, well, who knows, the spirit of the angels, you know, just kind of guided me there and made it happen. And it was unfolded in this kind of wonderful, miraculous way.
Gurdon, it's been just wonderful having you part of the program today. I thank you for being with us.
It's been a pleasure, a real pleasure. Thank you for asking me so many thoughtful questions.
Gurdon Brewster lives in Newfield, New York, where he's a sculptor and a retired chaplain. He's recently written about his summer with the King family in a memoir. It's called No Turning Back. You can read more about Gurdon Brewster and see some photos of him and his time with the King family on our website at thestory.org. And you can also read there about all the music we've chosen for today's program. Listening to Dr. King and listening to Gurdon Brewster and listening to the music, I'm wondering if you are in any way inspired to pass along your recollections of the civil rights time, stories from then and stories from today. You can get all that to us on our website at thestory.org. Or just call up on our telephone line and leave me a short message, 1-888-966-9862. I'm Dick Gordon. This is The Story.
The Story is a production of North Carolina Public Radio, WUNC, a broadcast service of the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill.
American Public Media.